1, 2, 3.
WRFI.
Watkins Glen.
Test.
Ithaca. WRFI Community Radio News is made possible by listeners like you.
Help us tell important stories about your community.
Head to wrfi.org/donate.
Live from the Kenny Ritter Studios in the historic Clinton House in downtown Ithaca, New York, this is WRFI Community Radio News for Wednesday, October 14th, 2020. I'm Michaela Savitt.
And I'm Fred Balfour. After the headline news, you'll hear an interview of Cornell scientist Dr. Taryn Bowerly. She talks about her research on plant response to water deficits. But first, here's a weather forecast courtesy of the National Weather Service. Tonight, increasing clouds with lows in the lower 50s, and tomorrow, mostly sunny, again, with highs in the mid-70s. Tomorrow night, showers are likely with lows in the upper 40s, and looking to Friday, rain likely with cooler temperatures. Highs will be in the mid-50s.
And now, tonight's news for Ithaca and Watkins Glen. Candlelit Ithaca, a retirement community near Trip Hammer Marketplace, has reported 4 new positive cases of COVID-19, according to the Ithaca Voice. The facility also closed their campus to all visitations and is now sending both mail and meals straight to residents. All health center workers are being tested every Wednesday. The 4 positive cases were revealed to be 3 health center staff members and 1 resident. All of them spent extended amounts of time in the health center. Kendall announced on Facebook that the employees who tested positive were working in different areas of the health center. Kendall residents received an email stating the details of the new positive cases in the community this week. When the Ithaca Voice asked about the cases at Kendall, the Tompkins County Health Department declined to comment.
Ithaca college students living out of state and seeking mental health care are having difficulty navigating the state and national regulations pertaining to mental health care providers. The majority of the IC students are attending classes remotely due to the COVID-19, and many mental health care providers have switched to providing counseling via telehealth. However, according to New York State licensing restrictions, counselors with Ithaca College Counseling and Psychological Services, or CAPS, can only provide clinical telehealth services to students living in New York State. CAPS has 11 mental health providers on its staff, and some have been temporarily certified to offer telehealth to students residing outside of New York State. But the duration of these licenses varies. Brian Peterson, director of CAPS, says that his office is helping students who are living outside of New York to find mental health providers in their area. Peterson hopes the current COVID-19 crisis forces the American Psychological Association and other professional governing bodies to work to create uniform standards for licensed therapists across the U.S.
Cornell University's reopening plan has seemingly worked, as there are only 7 new positive cases of the virus as of last week, reports the Cornell Daily Sun. And since the start of the semester on September 2nd, there have only been 100 new cases, compared to Cornell's initial projection of over 1,200 positive cases. The president and provost of Cornell University wrote in an op-ed in the Washington Post explaining how the school's policies of mask wearing and socially distanced classrooms have prevented a significant spread of the virus among students. Cornell's COVID-19 education plan has received national attention. Footage of masked and socially distanced Cornell students were featured on a Good Morning America segment, and schools across the country are attempting to follow Cornell's COVID-19 education plan. However, the president and provost stress that many schools may not be able to follow in their footsteps. They're citing reasons such as Cornell's uniquely isolated location in upstate New York and the fact that their university has access to its own labs.
Looking at the local COVID-19 caseload, the latest numbers released today from the Tompkins County Health Department indicate that there are 7 additional positives and 5 new recoveries. According to the county health department, that leaves 48 active cases of COVID in Tompkins. In Schuyler County, there are no new cases of COVID-19 reported as of today, according to their health department. 5 are hospitalized with complications from the virus, and 14 active cases remain. Michigan, Ohio, and Virginia have been added to New York's travel advisory, which includes over 30 states. Visitors from those areas must quarantine for 2 weeks upon arriving in New York. See the full list of states at the website coronavirus.health.ny.gov. That's coronavirus.health.ny.gov.
In New York State news, the first New York offshore wind farm will deliver enough electricity to power 70,000 homes on Long Island. Andrea Sears with the Public News Service has the story.
New York is one step closer to bringing the first offshore wind power to thousands of homes on Long Island. The New York Department of Public Service and 4 other state agencies have signed a joint proposal on the siting of the transmission line that will connect an offshore wind farm to the Long Island Power Authority grid. The project is relatively small, bringing only 130 megawatts of power ashore. But according to Joe Martens, director of the New York Offshore Wind Alliance, the joint proposal is a significant milestone in reaching the state's goal of generating 9,000 megawatts of offshore wind power by 2035.
This is important because it's really symbolic that the process is attainable, that the goal can be achieved, and the construction can actually start.
Final state approval of the transmission line is expected within the next 5 months. Construction of the transmission line can't begin until construction of the wind farm itself has been approved. Martens says those permit applications are being reviewed by the Federal Bureau of Offshore Energy Management.
The federal approvals, we hope, will also be rendered next year, so the construction of the project could start in 2021.
Construction of the wind farm is expected to create hundreds of new jobs and spur investment in ports and other vital infrastructure. New York State is mandated to produce 70% of its electricity from renewable sources by 2030 and to achieve 100% carbon-free electricity within the next 20 years. And Martens points out that offshore wind will play a major role.
Offshore wind is critical, and we need to get significant offshore wind in order to meet both the state's renewable energy goal and its emission-free goal by 2040.
Last month, Governor Andrew Cuomo proposed new regulations to speed up the siting and construction of major renewable energy projects to help meet the state's clean energy goals. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
In a new book, Lumina Foundation president and chief executive says it's time to rethink higher education and workforce training to sustain the future U.S. workforce in an age of robotics and artificial intelligence. More from Nadia Ramlagan with the Public News Service.
Uniquely human traits and capabilities will be more important in the post-coronavirus work landscape, says Jamie Marisotis, author of a new book on the future of the workforce. At least one study estimates 40% of jobs that saw COVID-related layoffs aren't coming back. And Marisotis says the crisis offers the opportunity for large-scale rethinking of higher education and workforce training programs. He says even before the pandemic, Tennessee state government, the largest public employer in the state with 42,000 workers, has been leading the way.
For the state of Tennessee, I think what we've seen is that there really has been a cultural change, that training isn't just something that you do once, but it's a continuous process. The state has recognized that learning as part of work is really important.
He says rather than a one-time job fair, the state has 28 management and training programs employees can take advantage of. But employers are only part of the picture. Marisotis notes the 40-plus million Americans still out of work need massive federal investment in community colleges that award associate degrees and short-term credentials to help them move into new sectors. Marisotis says the government should be focusing on the value of human work skills and attributes. He points out that people who've honed the ability to communicate, motivate themselves, and work in teams tend to have higher levels of education and are able to work from home. And they've largely been spared from pandemic job loss.
understanding how we serve other people as part of our work, how we use our compassion and our creativity and all of the things that make us human to be more effective in our jobs. So the education and training system, I think, will need to change.
Marisotis adds that because Black, Latino, and Indigenous workers have been disproportionately affected by COVID-19, workforce training programs must adapt to better serve these communities.
And we need to make sure that building our human work ecosystem takes those individuals into account and does a better job, frankly, than what we've done in the past.
In the latest national poll, 60% of Black respondents said their households face serious financial problems and income loss in the pandemic. 72% of Latino and 55% of Native American respondents report struggling financially, compared with 36% of whites. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Romlagan.
And yesterday marked the start of early voting in Texas. Plus, voter registration in six states, including Virginia, where the website crashed. And Supreme Court confirmation hearings continue today. More on the latest U.S. election news, courtesy of our friends at Pacifica Network, and once again, the Public News Service.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
This year, more than ever, people, at least here in Texas, are extremely eager to vote. If that means waiting in lines for hours with a mask on, you know, they're going to do it.
Reporter Eric De La Garza with Courthouse News in San Antonio, Texas, spoke with voters in line yesterday for their first day of early voting. He reports a lot of enthusiasm despite hours-long lines. There were even lines for ballot drop boxes after a federal court recently upheld the restriction of one per Texas county, no matter how large. Deadlines yesterday for voter registration in Kansas, Louisiana, New Jersey, Oregon, Virginia, and West Virginia. Virginia's voter registration website went down for hours because of an accidentally cut cable. Governor Ralph Northam supports an extension.
We're working with the courts, looking at all our options to extend the deadline for registration so that if there's time that people have lost, they'll be able to accommodate that.
Northam also may have been a second target of the plot thwarted by the FBI to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and storm the state capitol. Northam's statewide stay-at-home order in March drew ire from the president, who at the time falsely tweeted that Virginia was, quote, under siege.
When language is used such as to liberate Virginia, people, they find meaning in those words, and thus these things happen, and that's regrettable.
During Trump's Supreme Court nominee Judge Amy Coney Barrett's second day of confirmation hearings, 88 of her faculty colleagues from the University of Notre Dame publicly asked her to halt the nomination until after the election, saying her acceptance at this time would, quote, undermine confidence in the court, unquote, among other things, though faculty from the law school have supported her nomination. At the hearing, Barrett declined to answer whether it's illegal to intimidate voters at polling places. It is. Or whether the president has the authority to delay the election, he does not.
If I give off-the-cuff answers, then I would be basically a legal pundit, and I don't think we want judges to be legal pundits.
She also declined to say if she would recuse herself from the upcoming Affordable Care Act case. In the past, she criticized the court for declining to strike down a key part of the law. The same day, the current Supreme Court ruled the Trump administration can halt the census now to meet upcoming reporting deadlines. Despite delays due to the pandemic, it had been extended from July. Lawyer Yurish Rudensky with the Brennan Center for Justice says already marginalized communities are hurt most by an inaccurate count.
These are poor areas. These are areas that are predominantly people of color. It's where a lot of young people live, around colleges and universities, immigrant communities, and communities with a lot of children.
And on Twitter, Utah Senator Mitt Romney condemned both President Trump and a couple high-profile Democrats for making political debate a, quote, hate-filled morass. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
And that concludes our headline news for tonight. Coming up, an interview with a scientist at Cornell who studies in the School of Integrative Plant Science. We'll hear how the recent drought in our area has impacted plants. That's after the break, right here on WRFI Community Radio News. Stay with us.
The the falling leaves drift by the window, the autumn leaves of red and gold.
Nat King Cole with Autumn Leaves here on WRFI Community Radio News. I'm Michaela Savitt.
And I'm Fred Balfour. The Finger Lakes region has been experiencing a moderate drought recently. To learn more about how this is affecting trees and other plants in the landscape, WRFI contributor Esther Rakusin spoke with Dr. Taryn Bowerly for last night's edition of Locally Sourced Science. Dr. Bowerly is an associate professor at Cornell in their School of Integrative Plant Science. She studies plant responses to water deficits.
I'm Esther Rakusin for Locally Sourced Science. Listeners may be aware that Tompkins and Schuyler counties are currently experiencing moderate drought. A post on October 8, 2020, from Brian Fuchs of the National Drought Mitigation Center notes that one impact of moderate drought is stress to trees and landscaping. To learn more about how plants experience stress due to water deficits, I recently spoke with Dr. Taryn Bowerly. She is an associate professor in the Cornell School of Integrative Plant Science, Horticulture section. Bowerly studies how plants respond to water stress, both in the greenhouse and in the field. I started off by asking her about some of the ways that plants might respond to water deficits.
There are a lot of ways that plants can respond to water deficits. And really, a lot is dependent on the length of that water deficit. But generally speaking, plants can either avoid or tolerate that lack of water. So avoidance things might be like some of the plants are closing their stomates to prevent water loss, or some of the plants are shedding their leaves to reduce transpiration. So clearly, we're in the midst of fall right now, and so we're seeing a lot of that shedding of leaves, but it's not necessarily, of course, in response to the deficit itself. The shedding of leaves might have happened much earlier, actually during the summer months, for example.
I asked Bowerly to explain what stomates are and how they work.
So stomates are basically like small pores in the leaves, on the leaf surface. And so they're responsible for the gas exchange of the leaf. So just kind of similar to how we breathe in a way. And so the water that moves through a plant all the way from its root system, so from the soil into the roots and all the way through the plant, actually exits the plant through those stomates.
Bowerly also stated that plants respond to stress by increasing the formation of antioxidants. Here, she explains what those are and why they are protective to plants.
On the other hand, some plants can actually tolerate relatively well water deficits, so they actually can produce antioxidants that can help to really prevent cell damage. And actually, in fall, so during plants that produce a good amount of antioxidants might actually do a little bit better, at least for giving us the good fall colors. So they might produce some more of these antioxidants under a very mild or sometimes moderate drought stress. And we actually get to benefit from seeing those during the fall colors. And they're helping to scavenge free radicals to prevent that cell damage. So there are a number of different chemical complexes that the plants can produce, and they happen to result in some of these beautiful colors.
I then asked Bowerly what her lab studies pertaining to the plant response to drought.
But we actually spend a lot of our time looking at the below ground portion of the plant, so the root systems primarily, because as you can imagine, they are that first organ that is sensing water stress. And so we're very interested in how they're responding and what that means for the growth and livelihood of the tree or the plant. if there isn't any precipitation that's occurring, then the soil becomes drier and drier and plants can't maintain taking up water and they become more and more stressed.
Bowerly is interested in the integration of whole plant water status in relation to soil and root demographics. I asked her to define whole plant water status and how she measures it.
The measure of the water availability to plants and basically their hydraulic state. So how hydrated are they? We all, of course, in times like now that you mentioned with this moderate stress, that also encompasses what level of water stress might these plants have. Sort of our bread and butter, if you will, of techniques to measure water status is quite an antiquated thing. We use something called a Scholander pressure bomb. It's a very heavy and cumbersome piece of equipment that was developed in the mid-1960s or so. And we basically cut off a leaf or a root from the plant and we place it into this chamber that we pressurize and wait for water to come out of that tissue. And we can measure what something we call the water potential, and it tells us an approximate estimation of how much stress that plant is under.
I then asked her to describe soil and root demographics and how her lab studies them.
Yeah, so we say root demographics, or even more frequently, we use the term root dynamics. Basically, it's the process of measuring when roots are born, when they might die, and we try to determine information about that root population. And that tells us a lot about when roots are living, where they're living in the soil, and we use some below ground cameras in order to get that information. We will insert clear plastic tubing into the soil that then remains there for long term, and I mean on the span of years. And we have special cameras that fit into this tubing that we can visit whenever we desire and take very detailed images of these root systems. So basically track plants, root systems, over multiple years if needed. We primarily focus on trees, but we really measure all across the board. Most of the work we do in our lab is very question-based. So if we think that sunflowers, for example, might be the best plant to use in order to answer a question, then we'll use sunflowers. We're really trying to understand what these processes are in plants and how plants are responding to water stress. So we do a lot of our work both in the greenhouse, out in the field, in forests. So we really move around quite a lot.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locally Sourced Science. I'm Esther Rakusin, and I'm speaking with Dr. Taryn Bowerly about her studies of how plants respond to water deficits. I wondered if soil and root organisms might somehow influence the way that plants respond to water deficits.
We don't really exactly know at this moment, and actually that's a focus of several projects that we're currently working on, and several other labs, of course, as well, to try to understand that relationship, because roots and soil organisms collectively experience this drought stress, and to try to understand how that interaction occurs is very interesting. We do know that soil organisms, their community structure and who's present can shift with drought, but how that actually affects the plant, I guess that's to be continued.
Bowerly detailed what other questions her lab is focusing on right now.
So we're very interested in some of these concepts we brought up already. So where the trees might place their roots, how they might go deeper or change sort of their niche that they are growing in. And we're interested also in thinking about if you have multiple trees growing together, how that might change the process. And then we're interested in thinking about that direct connection between the root and its soil environment, and how in some cases roots actually can change or modify that environment through chemicals that they exude through their roots into the soil. And so we're trying to learn more about how that might help keep the connection of the root to the soil, or even change the microbes in the soil to perhaps help in that process.
Her lab is also studying what mechanisms take place when newly planted trees get established.
When you receive that tree, it can come in many different forms. It might come already in a pot filled with soil, or it might come as something we call the bare root, where a lot of the roots are actually removed and you really only have the structural root system left. And so many different formats that trees come in. What does that mean for when you plant it into your yard or into a landscape, and how those roots establish, and what role does water play in the movement of water in the tree to help it establish and grow new roots?
In a Cornell News podcast from last year, Bowerly stated that, quote, "We pass laws to protect our water sources like lakes and reservoirs, but what many people don't know is that our access to clean water relies just as heavily on forests." I asked her to explain why she compares forests to water reservoirs.
So I think you can think of trees or forests very much like a reservoir, or even sort of like a sponge. So a mature tree is made up of actually thousands of gallons of water. And so collectively, trees in a forest that are transpiring, so losing the water to the atmosphere, these forests are naturally filtering that water as well and cooling the environment. And so in many regards, there's a lot of similarities between reservoirs and trees or forests. And they're also holding on to a lot of water just within their biomass, as well as moving that water from the soil up through the tree. And so in many regards, sort of cleaning that water in some ways as well. And so it's an entire cycle there.
Finally, I asked Dr. Taryn Bowerly what else she would like our listeners to know about how plants respond to water deficits.
I would just say, you know, don't take trees or plants for granted, particularly in these times, even with moderate stress. They serve so many important ecosystem services for us, though, that it's really in our best interest to try to protect and preserve these trees and forests as well.
Thanks again to Dr. Taryn Bowerly of the Cornell School of Integrative Plant Science for speaking with me about the ways that plants respond to the stress of drought conditions. For Locally Sourced Science, I'm Esther Rakusin.
WRFI contributor Esther Rakusin with her interview from last night's edition of Locally Sourced Science. She was speaking with Dr. Taryn Bowerly, associate professor in the Cornell School of Integrative Plant Science and Horticulture section. This aired on the October 13th edition of WRFI's Science Radio Show. Hear more shows of theirs and subscribe to the podcast at locallysourcedscience.org. That's locallysourcedscience.org.
And that will do it for our program today. Our website is wrfi.org, where you can take another listen to the original news features by the WRFI news team. And to get the latest news on local, regional, and state stories about COVID-19, visit wrfi.org/coronavirus. And if you miss this WRFI Community Radio News at 6 p.m., it is now available as a podcast, updated every weeknight shortly after our program. Take our show on the go. Visit wrfi.org to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
The headlines at the top of our program were written by WRFI contributor Esther Rakusin and news intern Christian Maitrey. Today's feature producer was, again, WRFI contributor Esther Rakusin. Fred Balfour was my co-anchor today, and I'm Michaela Savitt, WRFI News Director and Executive Producer for our program. If you have a question, tip, or comment for the news team, you may reach out to our team of reporters at news@ithacaradio.org. You may also call or text us at 607-319-5445. As always, back tomorrow night and every weekday evening at 6 with more of the stories impacting our communities. On behalf of the entire WRFI News team, take care, be well, and have a good evening.
One, two, three.
WRFI.